Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Audra, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Coping with the Stresses of Caregiving When Your Loved One Has Multiple Myeloma. And this is part two of Living with Multiple Myeloma. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I'd just like to cover a couple of issues. We now have over 110 participants on this call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Philippines, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call as well, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us learning about coping with the stresses of caregiving when your loved one has multiple myeloma. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Matthew Butler, and Dr. Butler is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine, Mays MD Anderson Cancer Center, UT Health, San Antonio. And Dr. Butler will be addressing an overview of the treatment of multiple myeloma, your important role in decision making, challenges in communicating with the healthcare team, the benefits of telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Butler.
Thank you so much. I really like being part of these programs. I've been doing it for a number of years. And it's really the same kind of conversation that I have every day with my patients that I take care of for multiple myeloma. So I'll talk just a little bit about how we treat it, how we think about the treatment, what the treatment is supposed to do, and then what it's like to go through it. And The first thing that the kind of hardest thing to kind of wrap your mind around when you get this diagnosis is that it is for life. This is not a disease that we ever say is cured or that you're done having to worry about. This is a chronic problem. And the mindset that a lot of people have or you hear about in the culture about any type of cancer being something that you have to beat at all costs, makes it hard to kind of process that this is something that's going to stay with you. But people live with chronic diseases all the time. In fact, most people have some kind of medical condition that needs to be taken care of. People live with diabetes and kidney problems and lung problems and liver problems. And this is a bone marrow problem. And when we treat it effectively, it can become a fairly small part of your life and just something that you take care of. But of course, it takes some pretty complicated treatments to get there. This is something that we weren't always good at treating. 25 years ago, the medicines for myeloma weren't that effective, but we've made huge progress. So the way the treatment goes for most people after a diagnosis, and the diagnosis itself can be confusing and go through a number of steps before the doctors involved, who usually aren't myeloma specialists, figure out what is going on and do the right tests and finally get there. That can be, in some ways, the hardest part. Once you find out and hopefully meet with someone who has some experience with the disease, you'll get started on induction therapy. So these are a combination of medicines, usually some pills that you take at home and some injections that are given in a cancer center, that are intended to get the disease under control. That sometimes happens quickly and it sometimes takes longer. it sometimes involves some side effects, although not at all like the side effects that you might think of if you've had loved ones with other types of cancer with they get the chemotherapies. We don't call any of the myeloma medicines chemotherapy. They're more targeted and more narrowly focused on just the myeloma cells than the older drugs. But that doesn't mean they don't have side effects, and sort of getting through that is the first step to getting the disease controlled. Some individuals with myeloma after their induction therapy will be recommended to go through a stem cell transplant. That's still kind of the standard recommendation for anyone who's healthy enough to do it. There are people that are older or have other health problems where we avoid that step. It sounds more complicated than it is because the cells that we transplant are your own cells, and so it's really just a matter of taking some cells and setting them aside, giving you some treatment to hopefully eradicate most of the remaining myeloma in your body, and then getting the cells back that were in storage. This involves a few weeks in the hospital, and in some ways this is the hardest part of treatment. After someone has done a transplant, we give them some time to just recuperate and feel hopefully normal again or close to normal, and then we talk about maintenance therapy. And maintenance is much more long-term, and therefore it has to be easy and manageable and something you can stick with and live a normal life with. And I have myeloma patients who get their treatment on their way to work, who reschedule their treatment visits because they're going on a cruise or traveling to a child's graduation or wedding or all those things. So being able to think of this disease as part of your life that you're going to live with and live well with, rather than something you have to beat and get put behind you, that's the shift in mindset. And some people really struggle with that because they've been told so many times about cancer being a battle. And we try not to make treating myeloma like that. We try to make it something that's just you. It's a journey. You travel through the steps. Hopefully, you make progress on those steps and get to a place where you can start to put it on a back burner again without ever totally forgetting about it. As we do that, we have a lot of choices. We've had so many new medicines come along for this disease in the last two decades that the challenge, the thing that makes this job hard is not that we don't have good treatments. It's we have too many, and we have to choose which ones. We have to choose how intensive to be with the initial treatments, how many drugs to combine, how high to give the doses. Those are all trade-offs, and the person going through the treatment and their family play a big role in helping to decide on what the right trade-off is. The more intensive the treatment, the better it works on average. But then again, the more side effects it carries. And it's really hard to predict. Some people go through treatment and have no side effects at all, feel great every single day. Others really struggle. And that means that it's not, these decisions aren't just simple one and done. You have to adjust and be talking. You have to have a relationship with your doctor every step of the way. And what seems like the best plan at the beginning might turn out to not be the best plan and might need to be adjusted. And that's part of it. The fact that in most health systems now people have access to their own results and data has really changed what it's like to have myeloma, because myeloma is a disease where the data, the lab results, are incredibly important. This is a disease that's largely invisible. The only way to directly see myeloma cells is to do a bone marrow biopsies, and that's something that's a bit cumbersome to do. We try not to do it very often. So instead, we rely on blood tests, and these generate a lot of numbers, and people get those numbers on their phone. In some cases, they've looked at their lab results before I've looked at them because they have direct access. That can be really empowering because every new set of blood work may tell you something new about how the treatment is working and how close you are to disease control or remission. But it also puts a burden on you because you're staring at these numbers that are really important to your life, and you know they're important, and you're trying to understand what they mean. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to, you know, talk someone through a number that they've misinterpreted and worried about when I'm not worried about it. The nature of measuring faint, tiny trace proteins in blood is that the measurements have a certain amount of noise to them. They'll bump up and down a little bit, and sometimes you get a result that doesn't seem right, and you just sort of put it in a bigger picture and don't overthink or overinterpret every single number down to the last decimal point. On the other hand, you know, there are numbers that I see that I think are really important, and I'm going to, you know, make decisions or change treatment on that basis. You know, as you live with the disease, you'll get more and more familiar with how to interpret these and what they're telling us. But I think you should do that with your doctor, not try to do it on your own, because you can get yourself a little bit befuddled, and it's just overwhelming sometimes, the sheer number of blood tests that we use to kind of peer in or get the best glimpse we can into what's happening inside your body. You know, I struggle to stay in as close touch with all my patients as I'd like to, because this is a disease where, you know, every step of the way there's new things happening and new information, and I rely on my nurse and the people in my clinic to be available. So I can't answer my phone when I'm seeing a patient, but if you call me, you'll end up getting to know the other staff that help me, and they are also get, you know, pretty familiar what can happen on treatment and what to do and how to advise people. And so it is, and then of course, you know, most people, it's important that they have a relationship with a primary doctor, maybe other specialists. Some people with myeloma develop kidney problems and need to have a nephrologist or that sort of thing. And so it's really a team. It's not any one single individual that can treat a complicated disease like this. But the mindset to have is this is a chronic, long-term thing. It's generally things change slowly. Generally, if something isn't going right, there's time to fix it or change, make a change and think things through, get some more information, figure it out. So resist the urge to panic the minute you feel something that seems wrong or see a number that you didn't expect. Take a pause, think it over and talk it over with someone who knows, and we get through this together. So.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bell. That was a wonderful presentation. Just very lots of information. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you so much. It's a stellar presentation, and since you're the first speaker, you set the tone for today's program. So thank you so much, and I like the concept that you get to do this together. That's what's so important for patients to hear. Thank you so much. And for all our participants, for our caregivers to hear as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. And Dr. Palos is actually her own healthcare team. She's a doctor of public health, a master's in social work, and a nurse, RN. And she's former clinical protocol administration manager, Office of Cancer Survivorship, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center, author and researcher in caregiving, healthcare disparities, and survivorship. And Dr. Palos will be addressing deciding to become a caregiver, your role in adherence, weekends, holidays, and vacations, coping with each day and on special occasions, anniversaries, birthdays, and managing family, friends, traditions, and the role of the long-distance caregivers and self-care tips for managing lifestyle with relaxation, tips and exercises for caregivers. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Palos.
Hello to everyone, and thank you, Dr. Messner, for the invitation to join this esteemed panel and audience. Dr. Butler established the foundation of today's discussion on the importance of communication. A patient-centered communication process is one that includes a patient, of course, their care team, of course, and their caregivers when making decisions about their loved ones. In my presentation, I will provide tips that patients and their families have shared with me over the years. Their stories have helped me to understand the immense burden on those who care for their loved ones during this stressful time. So I'm going to begin with a question for our audience. Do you believe an individual has a choice in taking on the caregiver's role and responsibilities? Few people plan to take on the role of a family caregiver, yet, you know, each year many folks find themselves shouldering the responsibility of caring for a loved one diagnosed with cancer. With increased life expectancies and medical advances, more people will need care for extended periods of time, and usually and increasingly more so at home. And family members are often the first one to step in to help. Becoming a caregiver for many can be a gradual process or a totally unexpected process. Either way, there's no doubt that providing care for a family member is a challenging and overwhelming one, particularly when you have to continue working, maintaining a household, caring for other family members, or your own health is compromised in some way. For today's discussion, we're going to focus on informal caregivers who are often family members or friends who provide unpaid care to someone with whom they have a personal relationship. So let's go back to the question that launched this discussion regarding choices. Does an individual have a choice in taking on this role and responsibility? I'm going to say it depends. It's an unresolved question. But there is some research that indicates that having a choice to take on this role can have a significant impact on the caregiver's physical and emotional outcomes. Studies indicate that individuals who felt they had no choice reported a significant impact, of course, on their caregiver's physical and emotional outcomes. They said that the data showed that they had increased stress and moral strain because they felt unprepared or unaware of all the responsibilities. And also, when asked if they had a choice in taking on the responsibility to provide care for their loved one, more than half of the caregivers said they had no choice in taking on this role. Family caregiving has been associated with increased levels of depression, anxiety, higher use of psychotropic medications, poor self-reported physical health, and compromised immune function. And those of you who are caregivers and have the lived experience right now know this. But yeah, it's just helpful to hear someone say that, yeah, if you're feeling some of these things, it's normal. And probably, most likely, you will need to do something about it. And I'll talk about that in a moment. I said all the somewhat negative to things that happen with being a caregiver, but there's studies of caregivers who report positive aspects of caregiving, such as forming closer relationship with others, developing a greater appreciation of life, and having better clarification of life priorities, showing more empathy for others, and practicing better health habits. So now I'd like to just kind of move on that piece and go to what is the role of the caregiver in ensuring adherence during any kind of special events? And what does adherence mean in today's discussion? Today it means following your treatment regimen, and you is the patient, of course, but following the treatment regimen, nutrition or dietary guidelines, physical therapy activities, and medication schedules precisely as your providers prescribe for the majority of the time. We all know there's unexpected things that come up. So let's discuss ways to manage the chaos associated with special times. One helpful strategy that I've worked with patients, and actually they gave me the idea, is to develop a caregiver special occasion plan. This plan would be similar to a hurricane preparedness plan, and those of you that live in areas where you're having disasters of some type, natural disasters, know it's wise to plan. A plan would help to navigate caregiving responsibility during those special times so everyone may enjoy the special event that's going on. The plan will also allow the caregiver to make some trade-offs in their roles when caring for a loved one. So here's a few tips that may be included in your plan. Be flexible. This is the best time to be flexible about traditions and customs associated with holidays or family gatherings. If your home, for example, was the hub of such activities, it might be time to make the changes. For example, ask another family member to host the event. You can prepare video clips or photo scrapbooks of past holidays. These type of memories can be shared with all the families or other loved ones who may or may not be close to you. If travel is difficult, you can incorporate social media into these events. You may be in one part of the country and someone else is in another, but you can use channels like Zoom, Skype, WebEx, or FaceTime to be present at the event. It's beneficial to have some lead time if you are going to travel for special occasions. Travel can, at many times, can be a 40-minute drive if you live in metropolitan, large cities, lots of traffic, for an afternoon visit, or a five-hour flight. So here's a few tips when planning a trip. Give your entire healthcare team notice that you'll be traveling, for how long and in what region. Dr. Butler talked about this and how that will also help kind of tailor treatments and regimens to those schedules of travel. Let them know if it will be domestic travel or international. Ask your team to help you identify tasks that must be followed, and if needed, to suggest alternative methods for dealing with some of those tasks. Keep a list and schedule of the patient's medications, their dosages, time to be taken, and how to be taken. And you can store this type of information on your computer, your tablet, mobile phone, or even handwritten notes. Just be sure to share them with important people that will be helping you during this time. Remember to write down the names and contact information of the physicians prescribing medications or that are on your healthcare team. And you might, at times, I had some patients share this with me, they asked their physician to write a letter stating that he or she has prescribed medications and then have a list of that medication. You can make copies of the letter and then give them to the family members and, of course, keep a copy with you. And so when you are flying, and that's part of your plans, keep your medication in a small carry-on bag. You may wish to keep your meds in their original or in pill containers, but you might want to label those pill containers. This is when that letter that we talked about from the physician will come in handy. So keep it in the bag with your meds and show it to security folks as needed when you're traveling. I'd like to recommend, and again, a tip from my patients and their family members, they always have a ready-to-go bag packed. That includes medical supplies, extra clothing, copies of essential documents, such as copies of prescriptions, contact numbers of healthcare providers, and members of your own circle of support or your family team. Trying to pack for a vacation or travel is chaotic without worrying about items you're going to need to provide continuity of care for your loved one. So these ready-to-go packs are necessary for the patient and the caregiver. Now, if you're a long-distance caregiver, you know that that can increase the uncertainty in caring for a loved one. When you don't live close by, it takes more effort to find out what's happening and to stay updated with your loved one's needs. Who is a long-term caregiver, long-distance caregiver? It's a family member, friend, who can live an hour or more away from your loved ones who needs the care. So here's a few tips for our long-distance caregivers. Identify friends or neighbors of your loved one in their area, right, in their geographic area. Ask them to keep in touch with you about your loved one. You can give them your contact information, a list of significant numbers, and email addresses. And remember to update it regularly. These are kind of like the welfare checks that people often ask for on their family members, but you ask the neighbor, so there's continuity of communication. With permission, you can participate in conference calls or video meetings, and you can stay in regular contact with your loved one's primary caregiver, usually by email through MyChart type of routes. It seems that the caregiver is always prepared for the patient's needs, but often forgets about their own needs. The roles and responsibilities of the caregiver will change throughout the cancer experience. So it's not surprising that as those roles change, the emotional and physical health of the caregiver will also change, and the caregiver might find themselves wishing for help. So many caregivers ask, how can I involve other family members or friends in the caregiving experience? Asking others to help is particularly challenging because of the chronicity of cancer. I've had folks tell me that they got a lot of support during the initial phase or when one was initially diagnosed with cancer and going through that first treatment. However, that support frequently lessens or disappears completely as the disease lingers, and that is when the caregiver is apt to feel the increased burden of being a caregiver. So here's some steps that may help. First, assess your circle of support. If needed, widen that circle. Ask neighbors, people from your place of worship, even from local community centers for help. It's expected to you're going to feel reluctant or embarrassed about asking for help, but stay focused on your goal. Increase your support circle for caregiving. Once the folks are engaged and when they're willing to do, they say they're in, it's also a good time to outline what you expect of them and the time. Giving an assigned role and tasks help minimize uncertainty about who does what. Also, when someone agrees to do a particular assignment, it becomes a covenant between the person who invited them and the invitee. Treat it as such. Let folks know the importance of their role as a circle member and how much you depend on them. Remember, if you take this bond seriously, so will they. And also, what I'd like to remind folks about is that people like to help, and if given a chance, they will most likely say yes. This expanded network of caregivers helps you, the caregiver, to lessen your caregiver burden. So a vital goal for caregivers is to keep tabs on their physical and mental health. Remember, caregiver burden stems from ignoring physical symptoms such as fatigue, interrupted sleep, weight gain or loss, or even increased colds and infections. A caregiver can experience, it's normal to experience anger, frustration, anxiety, or sadness, which may fluctuate depending on the status of your loved one throughout the experience. A word of caution, caregiver burden occurs when one is in a state of stress or distress for a long period of time. The combination of stress, burnout, and uncertainty about the roles can lead to the abuse of alcohol or other substances, so get help as early as you can. And be good to yourself. So the last few tips that I've had patients and caregivers tell me that helps is they've taken up meditation, yoga, deep breathing exercises. They say participate in any type of physical activity on a regular basis. Take up journaling, nothing fancy. One caregiver told me that now they're using their phone to record their feelings and thoughts, and that helps. And when they feel like it, they can go back and erase it. And also think about joining a support group, and Dr. Messner will address those resources in a moment. Take time for yourself. That's the message, even if it's for a quick walk around your home or neighborhood. Take a short nap or indulge in a long, uninterrupted bath or spa moment. It's amazing how that can also be so helpful. When possible, plan what I call a caregiver rest and recreation time, often referred to as respite care. Many caregivers would welcome offers for you to for someone to offer this type of relaxation time. R&R, or rest and recreation, will allow the caregiver to recharge themselves. You know, you can even allow yourself to grieve, cry, and express your feelings when necessary. You may find this type of expression can provide physical, emotional, and spiritual release. Remind yourself that you as a caregiver and the person you care for will reap the benefits of a healthy caregiver. So our next speakers will share tips for maintaining healthy hydration and nutrition wellness and provider resources that caregivers may find useful. My colleagues and I look forward to answering any questions you may have, and thank you for allowing me to share these stories with you. Dr. Messners, I'll return the program to you.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Palos. That was just a wonderful presentation. So many wonderful tips for everybody, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And I'm just going to say a few words about, I want to introduce Diana Bearden first of all. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with Michael E. DeBakey, VA Medical Center, and she is going to be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm happy to be part of today's presentation. So we've heard a lot today about the cancer, the treatment process, and some things to consider when taking care of yourself as the caregiver. I'm just going to focus a little bit more on the nutrition side of things. So during your loved one's, treatment journey, there's going to be several changes based on their response to treatment, potential side effects, that may impact some of their eating processes. But for the most part, the treatment side effects are pretty mild most of the time when it comes to nutrition. I want to say that what I see a lot in my years of being in oncology is families want to do everything for the patient. And the patient can do just as they have done before as long as there's not a struggle that they're faced with. So I encourage patients and family members to allow the patient to participate in their care. They don't need everything done for them throughout the entire process. It helps relieve the stress of the caregiver, for example, meal preparation. I talk to the patient whenever I'm meeting with a patient, having the caregiver there, because I want the patient to know that it's their responsibility for their health as well. Their caregiver's there to support them, but ultimately it's the patient who is going to be driving this. I see a lot of conflict sometimes between patients and caregivers, and it drains the relationship and it drains the caregiver. We heard today already that many caregivers, sort of neglect themselves, and they do. I've seen it happen for many years where they're not thinking about what they're eating. They're skipping their doctor's appointments. They need to go see the doctor because they need a renewal on their medication. Maybe they're forgetting things for themselves because they're worried about what the patient needs. And so what ends up happening is then the caregiver starts to have challenges, and that could have been avoided most of the time. So what I tell folks is have the patient care for themselves. Let them go through their lives like they have been doing it. If they run into, a speed bump, okay, then we come in and step in. But having them be part of that. Now, there are some things with nutrition I want to bring up. To make it easier, meal prepping. I mean, especially with appointments. And I tell families all the time, hey, if you can't make the appointment, that's fine. We can call in on the phone. You don't have to physically be here missing work or whatever things that you're need to be doing. But you can call in or to be on the video chat, if you're from a distance. The other thing is with the meal prepping is doing simple meals, things in crock pots. One-sheet meals. There's a lot of meal ordering services out there. I mean, it's countless, where they'll deliver everything to your front door. Oftentimes, economically, it could be better than going to the grocery store. You'll have to compare that on an individual basis. But even through insurance, we have a lot of patients who work through Medicare to get, and their insurance companies, to get assistance with food. There are services that are connected with your insurance and Medicare that can do that. Talk with your social worker. They're going to have a great, they're going to be a great resource for some of those. And there are meals that can be delivered. And these days, you can walk into the grocery store and there are several meals that are pre-made and you can put them in the oven and cook them. And those are easy, especially on long days for appointments. It's so true, and the patients will do better if they do more. I find that they have more skin in the game. It keeps them focused. It keeps them invested. It keeps them going. And so it gives them purpose. And so when it comes to nutrition, just be mindful that you don't have to do it all on your own caregivers, that the patient can help. There are resources out there to kind of make things simpler for you, pre-done things, et cetera. And taking care of your health is priority just as much as it is for the patient's care. Y'all are equitably important. So I'm going to close with that and hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a wonderful presentation, full of information, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national organization, a nonprofit that provides free programs and services throughout the United States. We have a HOPE line, 800-813-4673. And many people actually call our HOPE line to get all sorts of information. They usually call with a question. For example, I need transportation for treatment, or I'd like to get some online counseling services. So what do we offer for free? So we do offer, of course, practical financial and co-payment assistance, which is very important in today's era when people are really so strapped for the cost of their care. We also offer online support groups, and we offer them on every single topic. So we have programs for caregivers, caregivers of people living with multiple myeloma, young adults, older adult caregivers, LGBTQ community. So we have all types of caregiving online support groups. And you can go to our website at www.cancercare.org, and you can see all the different groups that we offer. We also have specific groups for people living with the particular types of cancer and their partners and loved ones. So there's quite a large number of groups that we do offer, and those are free. And we also offer, of course, a number of these workshops throughout the year, and they're on different topics, on different cancer topics, or also for caregivers as well. So if you go to our website, www.cancercare.org, you'll be able to see all the different services that we offer, and you can simply either access them online or you can contact us at Cancer Care. So now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. And so I'm going to ask Audra to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay. So this question for Dr. Butler, are there alternatives to medications for nausea?
Nausea is quite a variable thing. The first thing I'll say is that compared with chemos for other kinds of cancer, nausea is not a big problem for most myeloma treatments, but it can, this doesn't mean it's not, it never happens, it does. And of course, there's a lot of medications for it, but some people find other ways to deal with it. Learning when to eat and drink, when not to, what soothes your stomach. Some people crave certain tastes, strong tastes, peppermint or sour or sweet. Other patients like to eat as bland food as possible because the strong tastes are what, can trigger some nausea. So it's quite individual, but if you've tried a medication and you don't like how it makes you feel or if it doesn't work, that doesn't mean that you should give up on medications in general, because there are just so many options now, and the one that works well for one person might not be great for someone else. And so, if you got a prescription, tried it, didn't like the results, tell that to your doctor and say, is there anything else you could try? And there usually will be.
I have another question for Dr. Butler. My wife was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma recently, and there aren't any cancer centers near us. How can I make sure my wife has the best care team possible, and who should be a part of it?
Good question. So they're in a big academic center. If you happen to, you know, be lucky to live near one like the one where I work, there are folks that are quite specialized. So you have someone like me who treats mostly myeloma. Most communities don't have a person like that or a facility like that. But this is a well-known form of cancer. Anyone who is practicing oncology, and even, you know, there's a lot of small community oncology practices, should be able to give the treatments. At least the first kind of standard treatments for myeloma are well established. There are, of course, advanced treatments that you really have to be in a specialized center to get, like I talked about stem cell transplant. There's also cellular therapies called CAR-T now. There are special immunotherapies that have to be given in a special center. But those are, you can get excellent care in the first, you know, part of the disease journey without getting anything that that requires specialized expertise. Now, you still do have to have a specialist to prescribe them. And I do have people who don't have someone like that in their community and who travel to see me. That does make things harder, but it's not as hard as it used to be, because if you drive 2 hours or 3 hours to have a visit and get some blood work, I will do my best to come up with a plan where you don't have to keep doing that repeatedly. And that does limit the choice of treatments, because most of our treatments are injections, but some are pills, and it's possible to give reasonably good treatment for myeloma with only oral medications. It's not standard. You have to, you know, make it a priority and ask for it, but it can be done. And I have folks like that who also take advantage of video visits, which is something that wasn't even possible until the pandemic, and then it became kind of standard in most places where it's hard to do this for an initial visit. We do really like to see someone and meet them in person, physically examine them, have the initial set of blood work done in our own lab where we can, you know what we're looking at, and any other testing and imaging that needs to be done. But after that, I do my best to use local labs where we can send orders and have the blood drawn without a long trip. And then some of the time we can check in through a video and not have to actually be in the same place. And then the final way, trick that is sometimes helpful for this is, if you are able to see someone very specialized, but they're far away, and then there's someone who is more of a general oncologist in your community, it's possible to have your care co-managed by both of those people. So where you would see the specialist occasionally, get some recommendations, sort of check, another set of eyes to see how you're doing. And that recommendation may be give this medicine and give it at this dose, and you know, that's what we think is your best bet for treatment. But that can then be passed on to a cancer center that's local that can give those medicines. Most of these drugs are not technically hard to give. It's more just making the decisions, and that can be done without having to travel for every single dose.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Palos. What advice can you offer for new caregivers? My mother was recently discharged from the hospital after receiving chemotherapy, and I am having a hard time adjusting to this new role. It feels like I was given no preparation at all for the responsibilities I am taking on. Could you comment on this, Dr. Palos?
Certainly. Well, first of all, I want to encourage you that you'll eventually feel better about being a caregiver. And it is daunting at first, especially if it's unexpected to be to get put into this role. But it is helpful, and again, it depends on preferences and people's wishes, what they'd like to do. Talk to other caregivers. There's so many support groups out there. And I don't mean you need to go and tell them all of your life secrets, but just ask for a tip. You know, I'm a new caregiver, and my mom has the XY type of cancer. Can you tell me what you found was helpful in the first few weeks or the first few days? And so they can start sharing some of that information. Caregivers are very wise and experienced with the, you know, because of all the things that they go through. A lot of times it's trial and error. And so if it is trial and error and you find yourself in that trial and error period and you find that maybe at the beginning you're making more errors, you know, just give yourself some slack. It is hard. It is going to be daunting. Talking to others, though, has been found, and again by the research, because I'm a researcher, but the research shows that talking to others really helps when you're put in this type of dilemmas. And also, I think Ms. Bearden gave some great advice about the caregiver wanting to do everything for the patient. And, you know, one of the things she said that I think of, it's a patient's responsibility to step up and take care of themselves. So don't feel that you have to be the hero of the experience, okay? Just take your time, be patient, and encourage your mom, even though she may be feeling bad or even though she's maybe having some side effects from things, encourage her to do little things for herself, and then as she gets better, she'll be doing more things. But I would really say, if you go to the, let me just say this, if you go to the internet and start looking things up about how to be a caregiver, you're going to find all kinds of conflicting things. So I'd like to encourage you that if you are going to go online to look for resources, try Cancer Care, the American Cancer Society, the National Cancer Institute, and then so many organizations that focus only in that particular type of cancer. Those people, that, and they usually have some kind of line or some kind of chat where people come, you know, write in and say, this is what's happening, any tips, any advice. So good luck to you. I know it's going to be hard at the beginning. Accept that it's going to be hard at the beginning, but you will gain the experience and the expertise as time goes on. I hope that helps.
Thank you so much, Dr. Palos. And Ms. Bearden, a question for you. My father is doing well with his treatment, but has some specialized meal requirements that we have difficulty preparing and delivering in a timely manner. Are there services available for meal preparation that are economical?
Good question. That's a really good question. So a couple of, one of the ones that when you're saying specialized, I don't know if it's a texture modification or something with renal disease or diabetes, but Mom's Meals, and that's M-O-M apostrophe S Meals, has a lot of specialized diets. And I've had patients who've eaten the meals. I haven't tried them personally, but I haven't heard anything negative about the meals. And if he has Medicare or an insurance, I know with Medicare they have an agreement with Medicare where I believe they get so many meals for I don't know the exact, I don't know if it's changed or what, but I know there is some benefit, or there had been some benefit related to those. So talk with your social worker. I mean, anything you're going to do that's individualized, somebody coming in the home is going to cost a lot more money. You know, in my experience, and if there's, you know, ways to, I'm just going to say meal prep ahead of time where you put meals in the freezer, that might be one of the better alternatives to do. And, you know, do several meals, label them, and that way he can kind of pick and choose on the meals that he wants. Then you can talk with your dietitian, because anything that's super specialized, I don't know exactly how to answer that question, but I do know that Mom's Meals does offer a variety of specialized meal options.
Excellent. And another question for you, Ms. Bearden. Medication making me not want to eat as much. How can I make sure I am getting enough nutritious food?
Yeah, that's a great question. I deal with this a lot. So what I remind patients is you can't eat by your appetite. Because medications and treatment can infringe upon that, and it can alter it. And so what I encourage folks to do is set their timer on their phone, just like if you were setting it to take a medication or a meeting or whatever. When you wake up in the morning, I say every 2 to 3 hours, eat something. Depending on your unique needs, I don't know if there's any protein restrictions or anything specific, but what I focus on with my patients are high calorie, high protein foods. So small volume, big impact. And those are things typically that are an animal-based protein, cottage cheese, yogurt, milk, chicken, fish, tuna, those sorts of things. Bringing in things like avocados when they're appropriate. Every diet can be specialized. So, if it's not okay, talk with your dietitian and see if there's any special provisions. But adding, whole fat forms of your dairy products, measuring your stuff out. I tell people all the time, use a measuring cup. If you're not eating enough, use the measuring cup. See that you're eating enough. Those are some tools and tips you can try. But setting the timer is a good one. And even if you don't have to be hungry to eat, that's not a stipulation. You can eat even if you're not hungry. So if you're not vomiting, if you don't have abdominal pain, you're not nauseous, you can snack on something. And there's a lot of research actually when it comes to weight loss about what we call mindless eating. We actually reverse that with the cancer patient when we're trying to get them to eat, be occupied while you're eating. Then you won't even notice how much you're consuming. So those might be some things that can be helpful.
And I just want to let everybody know that we do have another program coming up on April 24th called Diverse Populations Living with Multiple Myeloma, and you'll be hearing more about that program as well. And now I'm going to ask our speakers if they could provide takeaways. I just took a one-minute takeaway. I'll start with Dr. Butler.
Sure. Well, nobody can predict how your journey will go with this disease. There is such a wide range of things that I see. Some of them good, some of them not so good. But certainly, getting input from the internet or from patient groups or from people you may meet who have myeloma, those experiences you can learn from, but don't think they will be what you will experience. Keep an open mind and see what the future brings. What we work toward for every single patient with myeloma is to have that future be as long as it can be and as close to normal as it can be. And that's more achievable now than it ever was.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Butler. And Dr. Pelos.
Sure. Few people wake up and say, today I want to be a caregiver of a cancer patient. But those of you who find yourself in this special role, I'd like to remind you to try to focus on these goals. Number one, make time for yourself, for that self-care. It's important. And to the person who asked about being a new caregiver and what to do, that's going to be one of the things. Yes, take care of your mom, but take care of yourself first, because if you don't take care of yourself, then it's going to influence your mom's care too. Two, find and ask for support. This is not a time to be shy, proud, embarrassed. The first time you do it, it'll be super hard, but after you keep doing it, you will find you may have to keep doing it. It'll be easier for you. And three, take a moment to celebrate your victories. Even if it's making a special meal that your mom always liked and she kept it down or whatever, or someone cares about. So celebrate your victories, and most important, acknowledge your strengths and your wisdom as a cancer caregiver. I think caregivers forget they earn that badge of honor of being called a caregiver. So good luck to all of our caregivers on this call.
Oh, thank you so much. That was lovely, Dr. Pallas. And Ms. Pearden.
Yeah, absolutely. So echoing everything everybody else said, realize you're unique. Your family member who's going through this is unique, and y'all's needs are unique. And so know your healthcare team. You may not have every resource that's in a large medical center like we talked about earlier, but know who you can contact and what they can. Know your insurance, know what benefits are, call them up, tell them what you're interested in and what you're looking for. If it's a food delivery, for example, like what type of benefit do they offer? most of the time, you know, I see, like I said earlier, having the patient be involved, they can do these sorts of things as well. And I see better outcomes when I have patients who are engaged, because they have the interest, they have the drive, they're getting information. That's whenever I see the best situations as far as, okay, getting through humps in the road. It's when that patient is, you know, staying focused and, you know, taking control of their health and playing a vital role in that. So know who to contact, know your benefits, and then reach out to us as soon as you need something.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks. And I want to thank all of our speakers today and our participants. And although we've done this program today, I must say your questions were superb and our speakers were wonderful, just phenomenal. So this was really a phenomenal program. Now, I do want to make a few comments, however. For those of you who had a chance to ask a question today, please actually take your question and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them the same question. Remember, you've learned a lot today, and you want to be sure to ask your question of your healthcare team, because remember, they know you the best. They have your medical records in front of them, and see what they have to say. And your question will be probably more informed because you've learned so much today. And for those of you who are in queue and didn't get to ask a question, take your question to your healthcare team, ask them the question, because you've learned a lot and you'll learn a lot more when you ask your healthcare team your question. And ask your questions regularly of your healthcare team. Also, I would like to remind everybody that it seems that during the day, most of you are able to reach your healthcare team, but it seems like evenings, weekends, and holidays are particularly challenging. So always check in with your healthcare team when you can reach them on weekends, evenings, weekends, and holidays. Also, remember, you are not alone. You are part of a community of support. Cancer Care is part of that support. And there are a number of other organizations out there as well. And what we'll do is at the end of today's probably in about a week, you'll get what we call a Survey Monkey. It's an evaluation of the program. But in that evaluation, we'll put in all the things that were mentioned by any of the speakers as a resource, and even some that we may not have mentioned during the live program, but we will include during, you know, when you get the Survey Monkey. So watch out for that, so you'll get those resources. And just remember, you're not alone. You're now part of community support, and we are all here to help you, your healthcare team, as well as all the different organizations that we're going to be sending you information about. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.